In this episode of Go Bag, I talk about my Delta Green game, Harrigan goes over the book Moonraker, I find out that I may have been monitored by the Russians, we get a grenade thrown at us by Mike G in encrypted comms, and then in our mission brief, we discuss how you can implement a teaser or cold opening into your covert action RPG. Hit it.
Strap in, operatives. This is Go Bag, your all-access pass to modern-day RPGs, loaded with bullets, backstories, and a whole lot of bad decisions. And here are your mission leaders, Sean and Harrigan.
We start off usually kicking off what we're tuned into as far as books, media, TV, movies, and Harrigan's got quite a few this week that he's tackling. I've been dead due to all kinds of different things.
Let's do this. Well, yeah, this is like the what you've been up to in the covert action realm. Are you giving us a pass? You haven't had anything?
I will say this. Delta Green, Convergence, I have run, I think 8 sessions, 9 sessions of that, and we did wrap it up. I wrapped that up last week, Sunday, as of this recording, November 16th. We got together. It started out with like, okay, last we left off, you were here, this was here, blah, blah, blah. Good? Yeah, but we want to do this. Okay, got it. Here's what happens. And then some things go into motion. They go and do this thing. And then at some point, I basically tie up all the loose ends. And it's very me monologuing some of those details for like quite a while, like almost 45 minutes.
For like 2 hours.
Almost, like maybe an hour to tie that up. And we were early and then everybody packed up their stuff and left. So now it's kind of like that is done. What are we going to do next?
So you kind of narrated to the end after a bunch of... Okay.
I don't want it to be like, okay, then we do this and then we do that and then we do this. And it's like, no, it's kind of like you've tackled the objective and it wasn't smooth. Like one of the guys went to the hospital, but I had him transferred to another hospital. And
is it something you're going to keep playing like with these characters, with this crew?
So I brought it up to the gang the session prior, because I'm like, depending on how this goes, are you guys wanting to continue to play Delta Green specifically, or do we want to do something else? Well, Jeff's all in on Delta Green. So he's like, girl, I want to keep playing. The other guys are like, okay, yeah, you know, whatever.
Sean just shrugged for those who are not watching him.
I shrugged for everybody
only
that can
me.
See me. So I don't know if I want to do just another scenario that is on a standalone basis, or if I want to roll out the big behemoth.
Impossible Landscapes.
Or God's Teeth.
God's Teeth, yeah.
I have a week from today to figure that out.
I asked for a reason, because I think we've all, as GMs, been in those situations where you're having to like tie up loose ends, narrate to the end because you either don't have enough time or there's pieces you just want to kind of draw back in, right? But I asked because with Delta Green, you could also, as opposed to having that like, and another thing, and now I go here, and the players are still in that like real-time mindset, which you don't want at the end. You could, if you were going to play again, switch to the home scenes, right?
Right.
So you could be like, it's 3 weeks later, where do we see you? You know, you burned the bond. Like you could do the whole round of that stuff. But I wouldn't want to do that necessarily if you're done with the campaign.
Right, of course. And I think right now, I fast-forwarded the timeline because I'm like, the scenario's ended. We fast forward a week, this happens. And then we fast forward a month, this happens. And then, you know, Jeff's like, hey, I want to get into like requisitions and getting my go bag together. And so he's texting me like everything he wants in it.
And everybody else is on their phone planning their next Sunday. Like, I'm going to do something different.
He's like, I'm going to check, you know, there's bureaucracy and, you know, us. And I said, well, it's obvious that Delta Green has no resources. They're not giving you anything. I'm positioning them as not funded. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay, that's fine, but they're probably going to look to you to steal this stuff for Delta Green, honestly. So he's going through that downtime period of what you can do during that. And I want to increase some, I want to you know, I want to do some training. And I'm like, oh, I'm sure the CIA would send you to a conference once a year, Jeff. you can go to the Gartner conference once a year and increase your little skill by 2 points or whatever it is. And then he's like, no, on page 98, man, it's got this. And I'm like,
fine. I attended a great roundtable discussion.
I'm no better at forgery. You know, it's like, whatever. Okay, fine. So,
you know what? Put a pin in this. We're going to return to this. I mean, we're going to return to Delta Green generally. But I think you and I have had many discussions over the years about how much it helps that game if the players all sort of deeply understand the roles they're playing, what game Delta Green is. It's not Call of Cthulhu. It's not an espionage game. It's, you know, it's this weird thing in between. And understanding the program and what they are. I had discovered, Sean, recently, and one of the things, you know what, let's flip over. I'll tell you about my week. One of the things I'm doing is, you know, I got these play-by-post games that I play. Covert Ops is now off and running. They're about to meet their first contact in Prague after kind of navigating some street life complications that are like holding them up. They're going to make them late for their meeting, basically, with their contact. But the other thing that I got going is a Delta Green solo game that I've finally gotten off the ground after many years of planning. A fellow by the name of Dirigible, who I've played many of these games with over the years. We've done lots of solo gaming together, but haven't in the last like 5 years. We haven't done much. So we're trying this again. And that, so whole point is here, I've sort of dived back into the Delta Green side of things. There are some conflicting things in the current material about how robust the program is. So in other words, the official one that came from Majestic post-2001, that whole program, if you read the adventures versus what's in the player's guide versus the handler's guide, it is not fully consistent. Maybe purposefully, but I think it's very rich ground for you and I to explore in, say, a podcast.
And to just comment on that quick, I have it set in 1990. I think their most recent is 1996. I think
so. They're outlaws then.
And I started it in 1995. Yeah. Right. But they don't know that they're really outlaws.
They just
know
they're Delta Green. Right.
Yes. Yeah. And they don't know it's not an official program or it is and all this. Like, it's, there's some things that probably will, I probably shouldn't have done that would, like, why would you do that in that era? But,
right.
I don't care what they think because they don't know anything yet.
Can I ask you a quick question about Impossible Landscapes? And it's sitting on the shelf behind me. I've never read the damn thing. I played in the game with you, so I purposely didn't read it. Does it address the fact that it starts off in the cowboy era and then, you know, how it does the time jump?
Yes.
Well, after the time jump, it's the program. It's not the cowboys, right?
Right.
Does it address that?
No.
That's weird, man. That's kind of what I'm getting at. There's some weird flux in it, even from the main authors, that I'm like, okay, last thing on this. Remember, what was the one you ran where we went to like Montana or wherever we went? Which one was that?
I don't remember.
We picked up the strange packet. I don't want to ruin it for anybody. There's the weird packet that gets intercepted in the mail. Yes. You end up traveling to like a pharmaceutical or some sort of manufacturing facility somewhere in the West, right? In that one, I remember we ran it and we felt a little stymied, right? If you remember it. And then later I flipped through it and this module was suggesting, well, they should just call in the special forces on the helicopter to assault the base. And I'm like, what? That, like, that is not the Delta Green that I play. And in no way did our handler, you, convey that we had these resources available. And it's where I think there's some jank in the way that some people run it or expect it to be run. And I think the misalignment can really kind of trip people up. Anyway, enough about that.
For sure. And I've witnessed that on a couple occasions where even that scenario, I'm like, oh, this is what they could do. Even the one I just ran, which is Convergence is the first scenario ever written for Delta Green. I don't know if you knew that. Yeah, ever. So it was originally for Call of Cthulhu, but they re-released it and updated it. And, you know, even Dwayne, I think, and it was that game, Holcon, he's like, why? How are you even running that? Because it has a permanent thing. So usually if it's a one shot, permanent thing, no big deal. You toss it out. It's at a con game. It's finished. And I said, I can handle that. I can change it. Like, that's the thing with these things. Yeah, it does say that. So what? I just nuke it or I provide a cure, right? Or whatever. But it is to your point, even Impossible Landscapes, I go, it starts right on the cusp of it forming.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. And if you read the lore, like there are assassinations happening where Majestic is knocking people off. There's all kinds of happening in the '90s around that stuff. I mean, number one, it's cool. I will also say this, and you know, I think we've already taken more time than I intended on Delta Green.
We could talk about it forever.
We could talk about it forever. Yeah. And who's the author? Is Detwiller, right, of the new game?
It's a conglomerate of them, right?
Okay, fair enough. I forget who wrote either the player's guide or the handler's, you know.
I don't know if it's a single person. I know, you know, there's Shane Ivey and then there's Detwiller.
Point being, I came across a passage recently that actually talks about what you just said, which is the just nuke it. It says Delta Green is going to be a little bit different at every table. In other words, lean into the parts that you like and ignore the parts that you don't, which any GM can do. But it is also a game with such a rich clockwork integrated history that people kind of want to get it right. So they understand it's 1995, how do things work versus 2010, that kind of shit.
Totally agree. Totally agree.
Yep. Okay. So, yeah, there's very rich ground for us to explore there is what I would say.
Could just do a whole entire podcast, not an episode, a whole entire podcast.
I don't know about that, but hey.
I think there could be a dead. I mean, there has been, right? There has been other
shows.
Well,
we should do a season on Delta Green.
So a whole season even?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I think we could. There's a lot. There's so much. All right, let me keep going because we're barely out of the gate here. I have just finished Slow Horses Season 5. I'm a big Slow Horses fan. I would say temper your expectations for this season, people. I love Season 4. Liked it a whole lot. Season 5, I think, is the weakest by far. And I was even thinking, oh, it looks like they've kind of run out of source material. You mentioned, I think, last week that these are based on books. This felt a little bit Game of Thrones to me, where I'm like, uh-oh, they ran out of the source material and the writers are running wild. And it's not true. It's based on a book called London Rules by the same author. And it's the same creative team doing Slow Horses. So I can't quite figure out why it feels so different. It's so much lighter weight in tone. I don't know. It's not terrible. The characters are still really fun. It's the weakest one so far. That's what I would say.
Even Breaking Bad had a bad season or two, right?
Yeah, there you go.
It just always does. I don't know why.
Yeah. It's a low point. Some of the characters act out of character. They take some goofy angles like, you know, oh, it's cute, it's funny, but they take it way too far and they keep returning to it. And yeah, if you watch it, you'll know what I mean. There's some not great fight scenes. Yeah, anyway. So the other thing that I did in the last week is I finished Moonraker, the book. So the third Bond book by Ian Fleming. And if you'd permit, there's some things I want to talk about with this book because it's really pretty cool. In fact, it's my favorite book so far. I really liked it. I think I mentioned before, it has some great like day in the life of an MI6 agent, which talks about like the office part of the job when you're not on the mission. There's many, many chapters on this fancy club in London where they play bridge. So the gambling there's a huge, I mean, I'm talking like three or four chapters on one bridge game that he's trying to beat Hugo Drax. I guess the thing to really understand is the book is absolutely nothing like the movie. It shares zero DNA except for there's a rocket and Hugo Drax is a character. It's a different Hugo Drax than the one in the movie. It's really great. Fleming has a real obsession with cars in this book. To the tune of he gets into like what the top speed of this is and how many gears that has. And it's all these like 1930s Bentleys versus 1950s Mercedes, and Drax has a Mercedes and Bond can't keep up with them on the road. Like all this stuff. And it's funny though, Sean, it can see it directly translating to the stats that are in the James Bond 007 game. Remember how we talked about how the author of that game sat and went through the movies and read the books and then was working on the game, like soaking in the stuff? You can see it in Moonraker. You can see the details that he was pulling from, that sort of thing. I will tell you this, that James Bond is not a very good driver in these first three books. He has two big car chases and he wipes out in both of them and gets captured in both cases. It's kind of interesting. I just watched the opening of the movie and you just see the movie again. You know how after the gun barrel sequence, all the movies have the fancy they get into the, like, the girls are just silhouettes swimming around, all that kind of stuff. I think Moonraker has a nod to the book in the movie opener, which is kind of cool. I don't want to ruin it, because if anybody wants to read Moonraker, it's actually a mystery. There's not very much action. There's no gunfights. I don't think Bond gets into a single fist fight, which is unlike the other two books. It's very much a what is Hugo Drax doing with this rocket kind of thing. So it's pretty cool. I quite like it. And then the last thing I would say is Drax is quite cool in this book. You know, if you don't want any spoilers, then stop listening. He is a Nazi. And not only is he a Nazi, because this, you know, when Fleming is writing this, it's not that long after the war. It's like 15 years after the war. He is a Brandenburger. Do you know what those guys were? They're akin to like the British commandos after the fall of France, getting into France and like blowing up bridges and ammo dumps and supporting the resistance. But it's the flip side. The Brandenburgers were involved early on in like the conquest of Europe, but later, after the Allies made landfall, these guys would like stay behind in places and fuck up the Allied supply lines, try to assassinate commanders, all that kind of stuff. So it's basically the equivalent of the British, you know, and eventually U.S. special forces. There's real, you know, coming in doing a little bit of research on this, I came across one really neat angle. There was a U.S. Canadian special service force that started in 1942. I had no idea. There was a joint special operations force that they used in Italy to capture. If you're probably familiar with the Italian campaign, Sean, they bypassed a lot of stuff. There were these big citadels and castles that they decided to not go after, or they were blocked by. And they used these special service forces to capture some of those, but with clandestine operations and that kind of thing. So really kind of neat. Long story short, Drax has this whole history of being a German commando in Europe and was also part of Operation, I think it's called Grief. Do you know Operation Grief by any chance?
No.
That is the German operation during the Battle of the Ardennes, what we would call the Battle of the Bulge, the last German counteroffensive in 1944, where they captured a bunch of American equipment, uniforms, cigarettes, like ham sandwiches, like all this gum. And they pretended to be GIs going behind the lines and were trying to strike American targets behind the lines. Really. So it's kind of cool that Fleming ties all this stuff in. So you can kind of picture where the rest of the book goes. But overall, the last thing I would say is it's a bit anticlimactic in the end. Bond sort of foils things in a way that unfolds slowly. That actually happened in Live and Let Die too, now that I think about it. Like the end comes with five chapters to go still kind of thing. And that slowly plays out how he foils things. This does something similar. And last thing, the Bond is often, you know, depicted as a womanizer and whatnot, but especially in the movies, but also in the books. He's a player, right? He's a mover and a shaker. In all three books so far, he has fallen hard for the woman. And by the end of it, he's like, there's no one else but you kind of thing. And then, of course, in the next book, it switches. But Moonraker is even better because he never gets the girl. And in fact, at the end, when M is like, you should go on holiday, Bond, and, you know, look after your injuries and rest up for your next mission and take the girl with you and choose anywhere in the world you want to go kind of thing. As Bond is telling her, hey, baby, she's like, yeah, see that guy over there? That's my fiance. So no. And the book ends on this like deflated Bond, like, oh, it's quite amusing. I quite like it. Oh, man. All right. Lastly, for me in the last week is what I have my targets, my sights on. I have had recommended to me, have never seen, and will watch next week, this coming week, 3 Days of the Condor. I've never seen it, and I hear it's pretty great. So I'm going to watch that.
Wow. I am a little surprised at that as well. Wild Wild West and 3 Days of the Condor.
You know, I mean, picture it, man. I'm old, right? So in the 70s and 80s, you couldn't choose when you could watch these things. While I did get a VCR eventually, I was not renting 3 Days of the Condor when I was, you know, going to the video store. So my point is, I was catching a lot of the tail ends of movies. I would see the first half of the movie, and then we had to go somewhere because you couldn't control when it was on, unlike today. So for that reason, I've seen bits and pieces of all these movies, but it's rare that I ever sat down and watched any of them like start to finish. 3 Days of the Condor is in that category where I don't think I've ever seen it start to finish. Did you not have a similar experience where you watched a lot of bits and pieces of stuff? I certainly did.
I mean, some of those movies, films, I probably saw later in life, right? Past Bond and some of those details. But,
yeah,
you know, it was probably my, I don't know if it was mid-20s that I was really getting into those, or probably maybe a little bit later. But so I understand. But not, dude, there's so many I haven't watched in so long. Like some of the Bond movies, I just have, even the book, like I mentioned prior, like the books I've read. I know I've read at least 4 or 5 Fleming books, and I couldn't tell you the difference between that and the movie to save my life because it's been so long. I mean, teenage years, like, I'm not reading The Good Earth, man. I'm reading James Bond and Ian Fleming.
Yeah, fair enough. And I was not doing that. I was reading fantasy back then. Yeah, you know what? I think it's worth it for people who are our age to return to those. I mentioned it when I talked about watching Dr. No. Like, I'm like, look at the quality of the film and how good this looks, because I was seeing it on a freaking 13-inch screen, fuzzy, with commercials, edited. So to sit down and have a cinematic experience with some of this material where it like looks really good, there are no interruptions, it's widescreen, it's kind of cool. It's kind of cool. So I'm looking forward to 3 Days of the Condor for that reason. All right, I've taken too much time already on just what I'm up to, but it's been a busy week finishing Moonraker, finishing Slow Horses. Let's move on to Sit Rep. Sit yes. Rep.
All right.
Give me the Sit Rep.
Sit Rep. I have none this week that is worth putting out there, which means zero.
I'm shocked.
I don't know.
You're the anchor. Dude, you're the guy with this stuff.
I know. Usually I'm like Googling stuff to find decent things to share like resource-wise, but you have one.
I do. I do. And it comes from some conversations I've had. There's a good friend of mine who's really into these. In fact, the same guy recommended 3 Days of the Condor. We were talking about older spy films. I'll say this, Sean, so far, at least me personally, I know for the podcast, I have leaned harder into the James Bond cinematic spy stuff in terms of the materials I'm consuming, what I talk about, the fact that I like the 007 game so much. But I want to make sure I'm balancing that out and going in with the more grounded stuff that I think you prefer, the Cold War side of things. Yes?
I have an appreciation for both. But
so I do too, but I've been leaning maybe too hard one way. We're talking about code breaking and all kinds of things like that. And he's telling me about this cool stuff that happens in 3 Days of the Condor, which is why I want to watch it. And it spurred a memory of mine. And then I did a little bit of Googling to find out if it was true or not, because my father, who used to work for the Canadian Department of Defense, used to tell me that in the 60s, where the DOD, not DND, the DOD, Department of Defense in Canada, so Halifax is a huge military base, right? Big naval base, et cetera. He told me that the Russians used to sit offshore, and I didn't know whether to believe this or not, and listen to the IBM Selectric typewriters, and that they would be able to log what the typists were typing by listening to them. And I didn't know if that was true. I mean, I always thought, thinking like, wow, that's crazy. I got to the bottom of it. And the link that you can put in the show notes is about how these Russians did have this whole plot around IBM Selectric typewriters, but it was really at embassies in the Soviet Union is where they employed them. But I think what my dad was getting at, you know, he was talking to a kid at the time. I think when they discovered it in the mid 60s, the typewriters were introduced in 1961. They went all over the world. You guys can picture it. It's that round ball typewriter that IBM had where the, you know, it makes a very distinctive sort of sound. The Russians actually put keyloggers into the machines, mechanical devices into the machines that transmitted every keystroke to somewhere nearby. So they were getting everything the diplomats were sending back and that was coming in and being retyped and all that kind of stuff, right? I think what my dad was getting at was that when that plot was unveiled, the IBMs were flagged as a, you know, a source of moleness, whatever you want to call it. So I suspect they either had to not use that brand of typewriter, or they had to do inspections to make sure they weren't. So it's not, in other words, the Russians weren't sitting offshore listening, but they would have had a way to install the devices and be closer and have those things transmitted and make off with the materials. It's kind of a cool story.
It is. And it's modern day. They are wondering like why the government is banning certain equipment from coming into the US from China.
You know what? I have, not just because of this, I think you may know, like in my history, my employment history, I'm near what is called operational technology, right? Process control, SCADA, industrial controls, those sorts of things. The Chinese have actually had things in industrial control since the 70s that they can turn on and off at will. It's terrible. Lately with TikTok, with quite frankly, with drones, like my current company has a big drone program and we've had to go through and get rid of every single Chinese drone. I hate to say it, but the Chinese have done it. And the same thing is true for all the networking stuff they put into Europe. I'm forgetting the company even that did that. You recall who was that Chinese company that offered
Huawei,
all those?
Is it?
No, I don't think it's Huawei. I think it's the, maybe it is. In any case, they gave sweetheart deals all over Europe and all over Africa. And our intelligence services were like, no, you shouldn't be putting that stuff in. And it's clear why you shouldn't. And the Russian thing is kind of an older version of that. It's like a USB keylogger that you would see now in a spy, in a real, you know, these things are real. The Russians were doing it, you know, 50 years ago, 60 years ago.
I mean, I did learn on an IBM Ball typewriter.
Selectric.
Yeah. But it was the 80s and it was keyboarding, and that's how I learned to type. So I might have sent them all kinds of AA, AS, AB, A semi, AA, TTA.
ASDF, JKLM.
Well, I mean, that's how our teacher taught us. She would just yell out letters and numbers, and that's what you were doing. And then whenever you walked by that room, it sounded like it was loud as hell because you had like 20 students typing on these typewriters at the same time.
Mine was also keyboarding. It wasn't called typing. It was keyboarding at the time. And I, you know what? I remember the machines. Those IBMs were freaking tanks. Do you remember them?
Oh, they weighed like 25 pounds.
More than that, I think. Maybe. They were probably made in the 60s and had just found their way into the schools, you know?
I was much smaller then too. So 25 pounds would have probably broken me, but.
True. That's very true. So that's all I had for SITREP, but I thought just kind of a cool, you know, real world espionage kind of leak of information in a way you wouldn't think about. Kind of neat.
Very cool. That is very cool. Yeah. All right, let's get into encrypted comms.
Sir, we have an incoming encrypted transmission.
Do we have one this week?
I've been talking a lot, so you're reading it, my friend.
You want me to read it? All right, I'll read it.
I do.
This one comes from Mike G. Thanks, Mike. So he says, hey guys, found your show and really enjoying it. First is a media recommendation. Always like those. Podcast Wind of Change, in which a reporter chases an urban legend, apparently from inside the CIA itself, that the song Wind of Change by the German band The Scorpions is actually a CIA PSYOP campaign.
Nice.
Yeah, this hits home because I've seen The Scorps twice. Yeah. So anyways, he continues, his leads take him on many divergent threads. So it's not all spy stuff, but definitely a diverse set of characters. 8 episodes, about 45 minutes each with a couple of bonus episodes. So I'm going to have to maybe check that out. I was like oblivious to that. I don't know if I ever heard of the rumor. Have you ever heard that rumor?
Hell no.
I knew that it had to do with the Cold War, right? That song is about the winds of change, and you listen to the lyrics and it has to do with like,
oh, I didn't know. See, I'm not a Scorpions guy.
Yeah.
I can name one Scorpions song.
The Zoo Man.
Rock Me Like a Hurricane Man.
No, that's where you're wrong. Okay.
Blackout. I'm not wrong. It's the only one I know. Well, so I'm not wrong.
The album Blackout. Now here we go on Scorps. Now welcome to the music podcast that we're covering the Scorpions.
So is that a late Scorpion song, an early Scorpion song, the Rock Me Like a Hurricane thing?
I think.
So you're saying I need to listen to their earlier catalog to get to the true Scorpions.
In my humble opinion.
Yeah. Okay. I'll see about that. Yeah. They're German, man. And yeah.
Hey, rock.
Germans and hard rock. I don't know, man.
Okay. Well, I'm not here to debate that. Anyways.
Nope.
He continues. Second, have you played Palladium's take on the genre, ninjas and super spies?
Pass. Okay, no, I'll answer. Purposely, no. I have not. I'm not a Palladium guy. We will review it. We will review it. Okay. We will. We should.
I guess. I have not played it either, for the record. So.
I mean, it's an 80s game. It's one of the early ones, man. It was like second wave.
I've never played anything Palladium Rifts, anything derivative from Palladium.
We will have to get somebody who knows the material better than I do. Like, I had Palladium Fantasy in my travels of, can we please play anything that isn't AD&D? Please. And the dudes rejected Palladium Fantasy as well. I think we made characters. That's it. And I have some nostalgic, like, love for that book when I go through it. There's some things that they did differently than AD. It's so clearly based on AD&D. But the reason why I mentioned that I think we should get somebody who knows this stuff better than I do, I think around about 1990, maybe early 90s, when Beyond the Supernatural comes out and then Rifts comes out, the Palladium system changes. So prior to that, it was very AD&D based. And I think Ninjas and Super Spies, Heroes Unlimited, I think it was called, all those Palladium books from the 80s are more like the original Palladium Fantasy games. But it changes significantly when they get into the 90s and they add a lot more to it. And I know that game system way less than the early stuff, is what I would say. Yeah, Mike, we will look at Ninjas and Super Spies for sure. Keep going, Sean.
My buddy Jimmy is a big Palladium guy. He's got tons of the books. Like,
yeah, the art's incredible. Like, yeah. Incredible art.
Continues, definitely more combat than Spycraft. Checks the hand-to-hand box with stats for 41 different martial arts. Wow. It leans to the fanciful with pages of cybernetic enhancements. The most interesting thing to me these days is there is a point-buy system for building spy agencies with point suggestions for various size agencies to spend over 14 categories, with the interesting suggestion of giving the player a point budget and letting them build the agency. I would definitely borrow concepts from this for whatever system I was running these days. Looking forward to new episodes. Agent Mike G.
Mike G.
It's his code name.
I love it. Do we need to review this game, hearing that? And let's tie it back, Sean. Not that long ago, a fellow by the name of, I think it's Hamza, when he wrote, was asking us about sandbox play. He didn't ask directly, but kind of about running your own agency kind of thing. So maybe we can have some better answers after we get into some of the other games. We've covered three games so far, people. Like, not very many, right?
And three, yeah.
We do not have an encyclopedic knowledge of what's already out there. We have to read these games to gain that, right?
Yes.
Yeah, great letter.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. If you are interested in throwing us a grenade, by all means, please do so. The easiest way is to, you know, email us at grenade@gobagpod.com or phone one in at 929-BIG-DICE. There you go.
Have a seat. Let's get on with the mission brief.
So we've talked about games. We've done a vignette that Sean is currently editing. Something a little different today.
Yeah, we've done a Q&A as well. But when we first brainstormed what the episodes would look like, we also talked about the subject matter or the approach, or like, pick one part of these games and unpack it a little bit. So whether it be combat or chases, or in today's example, Sean.
Teasers and pre-credit scenes.
Yes.
That is what we're covering.
Yep. Yeah. So we're focusing in on a specific part, one section of the genre. Typically the Bond, Mission Impossible type stuff often has these, what I've seen described, Sean, also as a cold opener.
Yes.
You're right in the middle of the action. It's usually in medias res when it starts. They have not explained who people are. They have not explained what the objective is. And what Sean and I are going to talk about is how that relates to gaming. Like, why would you want these types of things in your espionage and covert action game? And I think you have a nice outline or some meaty stuff for us to dive into. And I will add to it as we go.
Fantastic. So, yes. Why? And what we're referring to many times in the media that you would find this is at the beginning of a James Bond movie. And sometimes it ties into the rest, and sometimes it does not. Like, could be you know, how many movies have you seen where it's like, oh, man, I just wish it would kind of get to the action. Man, somebody over there in the production of Broccoli.
Yeah, they understood that.
And sometimes even in other role-playing games, people may say, hey, this is what you should do. But it's often, I find, Harrigan, I don't know about you, sometimes it's a con game. Get them into the action quick.
Oh, my heavens, dude. Yes. The whole con game could be the cold open, could be the teaser.
You're in the middle of a dungeon you just went into. Now you got to battle your way out. Boom, go.
I kind of won't run a con game that isn't at least in medias res to start. Like, give them a kick. Give them momentum. Get it going.
Now, I am planning on running James Bond for BS or Con 5 in January for folks that don't know about that. I kind of administer one, and Harrigan partakes in that, and we get lots of different games. And I'm thinking of running James Bond, but my fear is the cold open might take longer and, it, you know, like sidetrack the like main mission. But I don't know. We'll see.
Like I said, the session could be the cold open. Or, well, and we'll talk about this as we chat here this morning, excuse me. You could keep it very short.
So we get a few things. I think the first one where we start is what we've all know it to be, which is the cold open, which is the open piece of that, which is starting in the middle of the action. So dropping players right into the intense situation in media res, a chase, a botched extraction, a gun already pointed at them are just some of examples. Can you come up with one or two yourself, Harrigan?
Oh, yeah, tons. In fact, the little bit of work that I've done on this, it should either be a combat or a chase. They're trying to escape a facility. They're on a plane that's about to crash. Like, they're on a train and the bridge is out. Like, there's, and this is what I was getting at with the con game, Sean. If you want to keep it super short, it could be literally one scene, one shootout or one chase, or you have a moment where you're trying to, you have to jump off the train at the right moment before it all crashes kind of thing. It can be that simple. It can be more elaborate. There's more you can get into, but what they're really trying to do is get the blood pumping, set the tone, and when we're talking about the fiction side of it. I thought it was interesting that both of the three games reviewed so far, both James Bond 007 and Agent Provocateur talk about these scenes. They both reference them. Neither has what I would consider is a particularly good treatment of them. They're both like a paragraph or two that says, this is something you should think about kind of thing. Bond is neat because if you look at the structure of Bond movies, it goes in every one, except one. I think there's one of the more recent ones that puts the teaser at the back somehow. No. It puts the gun barrel sequence at the back of the movie. So the Bond movies almost always go cold open, gun barrel sequence. So the darn, 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 where he's walking and he shoots at the guy, whoever's holding the gun. Then they do the title sequence, which is whoever's singing the song. And as we talked about, the girls swimming around the screen, then they do all the action, you know, the movie happens kind of thing. So it's a pretty like a standard recipe for sure.
Indeed. So there's no setup. There's no briefing. Assume the players already know why they're there and then reveal the context as they act, not before. Have you used this in a game? Do you have an example of this, Harrigan? Putting Harrigan on the spot. I know he didn't prep exactly for this question, but
I didn't. I know that I have. In fact, most con games I do something similar. The best example I have is not going to be an espionage game. I'm trying to think of what we did with the White Lies game that I ran for you. I don't think there was a cold open.
Oh man, was that a while ago? Yeah.
It was a while ago, but when I ran a Black Hat game at BS or Con either last year or 2 years ago, I forget when it was, let me put it this way. The mission, the objective of the adventure is to take your petrified adventurer friend. So you've had a co-adventurer turned to stone and you're trying to find a wizard tower where the wizard was known to be a master of petrification and controlled like stone armies and turned his foes to stone. So the idea being travel to this remote tower. Of course, it's dilapidated and falling down. The wizard's long dead type of thing. But the cold open that I used, and we'll talk about why this matters to, like you mentioned it can relate to the plot, but it doesn't have to. Mine very much related. The cold open I used was you're in the bottom of this like inverted ziggurat snake person temple adventuring, and your adventuring companion, this person who gets turned, you know, who is a statue eventually, races ahead to try and defeat the big bad. And when the party fights their way through all the serpent men and you find your way in the chamber with the big bad, you discover that your friend has been petrified in that moment. So you arrive a minute too late, and then we cut from there, like, you know, from the realization that, oh no, they've been turned to stone, to it's now a month later, the statue's in the wagon that you're hauling up north looking for this tower. So that's the best example I can give you off the top of my head.
That's pretty good.
Have you done something similar? I bet you have.
I know I have, but I just can't recall in the moment.
I even did it a little bit in the Bond vignette with Egypt. Egypt is
you
kind of
did.
That.
You did? Yes. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. People haven't heard that yet, but they will.
They will. And you guys will be amazed.
There are games when you're not going to want to do this, because there's games, and in fact, Delta Green is kind of one of them. At Delta Green, you're supposed to be like in the break room eating a sandwich when the envelope comes, right? Or you're going to your kid's soccer game when you get the tap, and you're like, oh shit, I gotta work with the family to figure out how I can get away and go on the opera, right? So it's not for this is for the cinematic spy stuff that we're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, agreed.
Yeah.
So the other thing, next step, keep it self-contained. Pre-credit scene should be mini mission with clear objective, a few obstacles. Some would even say maybe not a few, maybe one, a clean ending, whether that is the escape, the capture, or the mission is accomplished. Think 10 to 20 minutes of table time, which is super short.
Yes. One scene.
Crunch it. It shouldn't derail the main story. It foreshadows it if you even want it to foreshadow the main story.
So what I've got in similar notes around this is keep it simple. Have a chase. You either are trying to catch someone or you're trying to get away from someone, and that ends it when you do, right? If it's combat, you are trying to defeat someone, period. I really like the one, there was advice, I think it was maybe in the Bond book, that was basically starting with them trying to escape like a burning facility or something, or a sinking ship is great. Because it's, you know, it's a single scene, it's compact, it's not going to take you very long, etc. So it's kind of good stuff. My own notes on this were without the, you know, not with the Bond or Agent Provocateur write-ups, you're trying to set the tone as well, right? For the, like, is this going to be a high action game? How realistic is the action? Get the player's blood pumping, make some rolls, teach them the mechanics. So maybe you're going to get to this, Sean, but this is the first chance you have to introduce mechanics to the table if they're new to the game.
That's the next one I was going to tackle, is using it to show off the system.
Yeah. Okay. So take it from there. I would also say, do you talk later about making the characters look good?
Giving each player a moment.
There you go. You just keep going, man. You're going to get to all my notes, I'm sure.
So the next one, using it to show off the system, the action mechanics. If you're in the middle of a chase, this is how chase works. You know, James Bond, we're going to bid on things, the risk factor. Right.
Yep. Ease factor.
Ease factor. That's the term. The ease factor.
But you're right. They get to know that you can picture it. You're holding up the character sheet and they're getting to know the sheet. You're like, here's where your attributes are. Here's your skills. See this table. These are the ease factors and that kind of thing. Right.
If you use signature gadgets, that can come into play. And then the game's tone, to Harrigan's point, whether it's gritty, pulpy, stylish, can come into play right away. So if you're using cats, right? Concept, aim, tone, subject matter. You know, if you're talking tone, high action, and you're talking to me in media res, intro.
You establish it right away.
Boom, bam, bang.
There won't be you start off in a bar moment in an espionage game, but there might be, I don't know, just sort of a low rent, kind of like you're going to the office, you're going to get a briefing, you're riding the subway, and you go like, that's not what the game, that's not how you want to run these types of games. Cold War games, a different story. But for these cinematic games, they're bombastic.
I would say this, though. You wouldn't start off with the mission brief, but I wouldn't hesitate to put in a flashback very briefly in the middle of this.
I personally think it's too short. I know what you're getting at. And if you went with a longer opener, you could do that.
True.
You could certainly do that.
moving on to number four, my list of criteria that goes into this, things that you want to keep in mind. Give each player a moment, the spotlight, do one iconic stunt, use a signature skill, deliver a line, make a clutch roll. And that's across the members in the group that's in this. And so even just talking about this as a game, from a game master perspective, as a player, don't be afraid to really lean into those things that are maybe on your sheet that highlight something, a personality component that puts you in the moment that you can kind of express.
Or if you have a question about how something works with the mechanics as well, like it's a perfect time to explore that kind of thing. So everything that you just, you did a much better job of it, Sean. Everything you just covered, I summed up in the, in make the characters look good. So it gets back to the competency and the, like, these are not dumbasses. These are really competent action heroes, you know, in the, in this type of spy fiction.
Man, I have it down as a highlight reel.
Yeah.
The next one, consequences travel into the main campaign. Now, this could be kind of more of optional, but not, you know, I also have it where it says not all consequences, just the narrative ones. So some of the examples that I'm referring to and would include an NPC they helped will may reappear later, or a villain escapes and becomes important. Like, it doesn't have to be, oh, it's this one scene and it all the rest, like, I want them to capture the villain no matter what. You can leave it completely open and whatever happens, happens, just like a regular role-playing game session.
My notes on this, all I said was villain or plot framing. So in other words, it flows into the main game. But picture it. You could even do the cold open or the teaser takes place 5 years before the mission. And you show the agents capturing the villain. But now, 5 years later, the villain, through by hook or by crook, they're free. It doesn't even have to be 5 years. It could be the kind of thing where, like, they got enough connections that it doesn't stick. You're like, I thought I put them away, but you didn't.
2 months across the screen. 2 months later.
Yes, exactly.
They retrieve a mysterious intel file they don't understand yet. So you could plant it now. They find it. They turn it over or whatever. It ends the scene. And then the main mission or the main scenario takes place. And then maybe two more sessions down the road, four more sessions down the road, because you do the scenario, maybe it's broken up. And now you've got that intel file that has been decrypted that was acquired four sessions earlier in an intro. Spitting diamonds over here, man.
Yes, you are. This is kind of awesome, actually, Sean. Like, workflow-wise, Sean and I will often take a game that we're going to cover and we'll either look at different chapters or one person will have the lead on a topic kind of thing. In this case, we're like, what are we talking about next week? We're like, what about these cold opens, these teasers kind of thing? And then we independently came up with what we thought was important. And for everything you just talked about there, Sean, the file you find, I just have world building. Like, in the opener, you can set the tone for, like, who are the agencies? What is the geopolitical climate like? What year is it? Like, all of that stuff can be set in the teaser. All that stuff. Some of it, like, you're right, might come up later as well in, you know, session four. Remember that dossier? Well.
And then the last bullet I have on my short list is their botched op leads to diplomatic heat.
Oh.
Right.
Yeah. In other words, there could be significant consequences that come from just this short little thing. And you can even do it dynamically, because I think all of us, probably folks who are listening as well, probably have some desire to not only play these games in this linear way where this happens, this happens, this happens, this happens, and the players are along for the ride. So in other words, you could do a pretty wide open teaser, cold open, and what happens if it drives the rest of what the next scene is. You could even do that. The GM is going to have to be fast on their feet to do that, maybe have a few things prepared that they can kind of go to. But I like that idea a lot where, let's say the cold open doesn't go the way you expect it does. I would say that most things that you read and most of the cold opens and teasers that you will witness, I don't know, they're pretty directed towards setting things up. In other words, a right-hand turn that you might get from the players failing where you don't expect them to, you may have to dance a little bit. But that could be a very cool way of starting the game. Kind of game where the GM's as surprised as the players are.
Yes. And then lastly, just keep the mechanics clean. There's no need to load the PCs with wounds or resource loss before the real campaign starts. Like, it's all, once it's done, it's disposable, but it can lead into the bigger campaign. But it's not necessarily having to have to carry over. Like, oh, you just, well, now you're on one hit point, you're in the hospital, and then the real campaign starts and you're still in the hospital. Like, that's not the way to do it.
One of the only things I don't think I heard you say necessarily, Bond calls it out. I think it's a great way of doing it. This gives you a way. So the same way that Sean is suggesting the consequences don't carry over. So in other words, like I would certainly use the wound mechanics, consequence mechanics in the cold opener for sure. But I think Sean's suggesting they don't, you know, enough time passes that when you're in the main game, you're not saddled with all those like things that happen. Conversely, meta currency, this is a way to build up meta currency going into the game. And we even had that situation in the 007 game where it's a little at odds with itself as to how much meta currency you start with, where it's like beginning agents have zero. And then it's like rookie agents have three. So it's like, I guess you mean rookie agents that are starting out have zero, but rookie agents that are not starting out have three. The cold opener gives you an opportunity to generate meta currency, either by awarding them for being successful, or if you're in a 2D20 game, hats off, Gabe. You can generate this momentum you can carry forward, because I think you just typically lose one between scenes type of thing, right? That sort of thing. So I think it's a cool way to kind of build up some, you know, mechanical meta currency as well. Do you know what, and I don't know if this is true or not, but one of the sources, the origin of these that I read about, did you come across any of that in your research?
I did not.
But why these things started happening, or why they put them in Bond movies and all the rest. It actually, if my research is correct, comes from the 1960s TV shows, so that the networks would prevent people from changing the channel. They did not want people saying, what's this, at the top of the hour, bottom of the hour, and like, oh, this is pretty slow moving. I'm not sure I want to stick around for this show, as opposed to they're on horseback or chasing the train. Who's that guy on the train shooting at them? You know, all that kind of stuff. So I found reference to Gene Roddenberry writing a memo about this type of opener that he used in the original series Star Trek stuff, which, if you think about it, always has a cold opener. Like, every episode has the bump, 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 bump moment at the end of it, where you're like, you know, some of them are more so than others. Like, sometimes they're on the bridge. It's a little less of a, like, not quite so in medias res, where, you know, they encounter something and they have to figure out what to do with it for the rest of the episode. But sometimes there's some of those episodes where they're like already on the planet. There's a play going on. Someone gets murdered and then Scotty gets accused, all in the first 1 minute of the show. And they're trying to hook people so they're not changing the channel, which I think is pretty fascinating.
And Kirk typically narrates what is going on. Boom, done. Like,
yes,
we're on the planet this to right. investigate this.
So Roddenberry's note talks about that as well.
Interesting.
Like, how you can narrate and kind of get there. Yeah, really cool. Like, I didn't dig into it deeply, and I don't know if that's truly the source of these things, but it certainly sounds like it's plausible.
Very, very cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I have a few other little things on this, but I don't want to take away from whatever your structure is here. What else do you have to cover?
I have make it visual and kinetic as my next one. 6 out of 10.
Nice.
Yes. So kinetic and visual, fast, varied, stylish, boom, bang, boom. Use changing locations mid-scene, which is interesting. I don't know if I would do it that way if it's a 10 to 20 minute scene, but regardless, take it for what it's worth. Vehicles, Harrigan mentioned, you know, the chase, whether it's on foot.
Yeah.
A tut-tut, a hut-hut.
Tuck-tuck.
A tuck-tuck.
Tuck-tuck. Tuck-tuck. Jet skis, horseback.
Train.
Mopeds, bicycles. Yeah.
Horses.
Helicopters. Yeah.
Yes. Hot air balloon. Whatever.
Yes.
Blimp. Ooh. I don't know. Throw it in there.
Blimp chase.
Improvised weapons, which is fantastic. Throwing the dishes at somebody, a bottle, a tray to block a bullet. Just get nuts if it's a high action. Environmental hazards, snow, ice, rain, make it slippery. They're on top of a train. They can't move very quickly because it's wet and slick. Throw in some sand, things getting bogged down, dry, heat, all that good stuff. Over-the-top stunt should go without saying. So this is not the time for a game master that says, no, nah, you can't do that.
I partially agree.
I'm talking about rule of cool, man.
Yes. So even though we're talking about cinematic games, some of these cinematic games are not like completely outlandish.
Well, I mean, can I jump up to the fourth story?
Exactly. Exactly. I would just temper what you're saying with the, like, what's the game on the table is all I'm saying. If it's Ninjas and Super Spies, as was recommended earlier, which is a little, I think, a little higher end. If it's feng shui, if it's the kind of game where, you know, the action, then yes, absolutely. But there are cold openers to the early Bond films, which are not like this.
Right.
They are very down and dirty. They are Red Grant garroting a Bond lookalike and murdering him while he has an audience of Smursh agents all clapping politely as he murdered them quickly. You know, and I mean, I know what you're saying. I'm totally into the bombastic action and like, let's go. But that's what I meant before by like, set the tone. Because if the tone is that like, anything goes, boys. Like, remember the Star Wars game that you ran where you were frustrated that we were having a chase. And we were kind of all packed onto the one speeder, and as soon as someone like jumped from one speeder to the other, you were like, finally, yes, action. Like, set the tone with
everybody's
that, right?
Oh my God, that drove me nuts. Like, everybody was on a speeder and they had stormtroopers chasing them, coming up alongside them. And they're like,
I think there was some pew pew, but that's about it.
I don't know what to do. I'm like, I'm going to jump on the speeder. That's what I'm talking about. The other one was, the last one I had was like quick cuts between PCs and quick cuts. Like even with some, like even Mission Impossible, I don't remember, like there is a moment where maybe Ethan is trying to do something and it's tense. And then he's talking to into his comms. And then it goes back to a van. What's his name in the van? That's trying to walk him through. As he surveys the building and makes sure that nobody's coming his way. So doing those cuts between the players to make sure that they're still in the action.
Mission Impossible does it really well. The newer, later movies where it's the spotlight thing you mentioned earlier. Like even if you have one super agent in Ethan Hunt and a support team gets nearly as much screen time, just as much screen time. And they're all performing some task that allows the agent to do the thing. So they play a critical role. And yeah, that definitely applies in the opener or the cold open just as much as it does other action scenes. Make sure that you're not just focused on one character. Yeah. Did you say that was the end of your list, or is that? Yeah.
I did. Did you have anything to add, sir?
The things that I want to talk about a little bit more are like we've talked about it a little already, where the teaser or the cold open might relate to the current mission, but it also might not. Like there are situations where. I'll struggle to think of an example here, but I know I've seen some. Diamonds Are Forever, I think, might have this. He kills Blofeld in the first like minute of the movie. And they're just trying to tie up loose ends for whatever reason. I think I have the movie right. Where he's got him on a helicopter, he's on the wheelchair, and he dumps him into a smokestack. Remember that? Like, yeah. Yeah, yes. Yeah. So they're yes. I think that's it. I may have the movie wrong. Point being, there are times when you are literally just establishing the badassery of the main characters. You know where I'm remembering now. You know where this comes from? The specific thing I'm thinking of is the game Operators. So Operators also has a cold open, and that cold open is basically show everybody who they are, what they're doing, and how kick-ass these characters are. Because these are, you know, rappel down from a helicopter into an office building while shooting your MP5 at the guy on the roof. Kind of, it's that type of game, right? Super frenetic, maybe nice Black Agent style of, you know, high agentry. And it could be that you are finishing a prior mission or just defeating somebody. And the next scene is the briefing. And now you start the actual plot. So they could be completely disconnected. Like, I like the idea of what you were talking about, Sean, where the things like the seeds can be planted for things going forward. You introduce the villain. There are plot hooks that you're aplenty, but you're not forced down that path. The teaser could be a smaller operation. If you're running a campaign, maybe you run the teaser. It seems to be self-contained. Then you run the main objective. And then later, two or three ops down the line, you return to what happened in that teaser. So the whole idea of like world building and making it start to seem alive and cohesive. Remember that character who got away, or remember that person you put behind bars, or that you thought you killed but didn't die because we used metacurrency, villain metacurrency, and they didn't die, right? I just like the idea that it could be something you introduce that shows up later. And then the last idea I had around kind of an unusual way to do a cold open, you can play schlubs. You can play goofballs in the opener who all get killed. And we've seen this in movies. We've seen this in like Octopussy, where the agent at the beginning, I think they have the Fabergé egg and they're running from the knife throwers and all that sort of stuff. And they end up getting murdered. But I think I forget if the egg is recovered or if it's lost. But point being, you can actually have the players play different characters in the teaser. They might all get wiped out. They might be low-level security guards, so you get to showcase what the villain is doing, and you're seeing it from a different angle. So in other words, the agents aren't on the scene yet. There's a bunch of movies and games that do this. The other one I've already mentioned is From Russia with Love, where it opens in a SMERSH training facility. You think you're watching Bond get murdered by Red Grant, and it's in fact somebody who's got the mask on. You don't have to just narrate that, GM. The players can play that, hand them little sheets. And that's why I know I've either seen this or done this, Sean, and I'm just drawing a blank, where I've given people like little cards with micro characters just for the first scene. And it even lets you learn some of the basics of the game because you don't have a lot of other stuff on the sheet. It's like a trimmed down version. And then as soon as that 30-minute scene is long, you collect those up because either the agent, those low-level guards get back to work, or they're all dead, or whatever it might be. And then you hand out the real sheets, or you flip them over or whatever. And here's where we're going to, you know, take this from here. But I do think that this idea of the cold open can connect in a lot of ways that are really cool. And you don't have to repeat it. So if you're part of my point here is you don't have to get into a rut where it's like every time we do an adventure, it's going to be a teaser or a cold open that does the same thing time after time. There's all kinds of different variety you can inject into it. I love the idea of these. Love it.
The one I have now is number 7, the using the teaser to establish a theme, which I think is a little redundant with ones we've already mentioned before. So if your campaign is about InfoWar, the opener would be a data heist that's gone wrong. It's more establishing the type of mission that might be coming up or that plays center stage long term in your campaign. So burn notices or double agents, the opener involves betrayal. Action heavy spy craft, the opener involves a rooftop chase, something similar. Political intrigue type of campaign, you would have the opener be a diplomatic sting gone sideways, perhaps. Just some examples. It's basically letting the cold opener telegraph what kind of game this will be. So not only just tone, but actually some of the centric theme of what the campaign may involve. This is just another idea that you could throw in there. Going to your point, I think, the cliffhanger or punchline, says end on a cliffhanger or punchline I have, which kind of talks to you a little bit about like the villain gets away, the agents escape by inches, some of which we kind of rehashed already or hashed. A mysterious device explodes, a double agent is revealed, a baffling piece of intel changes everything, and smash cut to a title sequence. So it feels like a Netflix episode cliffhanger, you did it right kind of thing.
Let me just chime in on that because I think I don't know if we had talked about this in detail. One of the things that could be pretty cool, like you said, it's not just tone. It could be the subject matter of the game.
Correct.
And maybe the subject matter is you're burned. You're on the outside of your agency. You no longer have their support. And the opening scene could be agents just trying to take you out and you don't know why. You're like, what? Who are these guys? At the end of the cold open, you realize, holy shit, they're CIA or insert agency here. And then when you flow into it now, but what is the game about? The game is about like, you're not going to get a briefing. You're going to be pulling your team together, trying to understand what's going on, what happened. And there's many different versions of that. So it gets back to the, like, this is not as limited as you think. This does not have to be just a chase that is meaningless. It can actually set the whole thing up and get it rolling in the right way.
Well, and to capitalize on that, so typically you would as a game master show up to the table and go, okay, let me tell you what this game's about. And then you would just say, you would convey that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the GM. I'm telling you what you guys are as far as agents. Instead of, okay, we're going to do a cold opener. This is what happens.
You can bake in some of your cats into the cold opener.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And what Harrigan mentioned is cats is not your animal cats, but the concept, aim, tone, and subject matter. Right.
Right. Where you normally would go through that out of character and say, hey, everybody, you could establish a lot of that in that first scene.
Number eight.
You know, I just had a thought. You know what you could do?
Yeah.
And I'm for whatever reason, I'm thinking a lot of like con games here, because con games have that whole thing where you have to get the table like quickly on the same page. Come on, everybody. Let's all get marching in the same direction. Right. Because, you know, and I rant about this in Harrigan's Hearth all the time, or about how I want the GM to have a better presence at the table at the start of a game, and I want them to introduce people and find out why they're playing and whether they played before, what they want out of the game, etc. I also like, flip side of that, sit down, hand out these little one-off characters, run the first scene right away. When you finish it, then get into, like, you've already covered a bunch of the cat stuff, right? You've established the tone, the subject matter, what the game's about, some of the rules. Then you could actually take a 10 minute, like, out of character and say, you know, so here's where we are. We've just finished this. Here's what we're going to try to accomplish in the next little while. You can kind of break it up that way. More like literally a teaser before you even like discuss the game. Run the little session. Don't have people introduce themselves. And then in the middle, you know, 20 minutes later, you can do a little bit of the what I would like to see people do, which is the whole, like, let's talk a little bit in a meta sense about why we're here and what we're doing today, that kind of thing. I could see that working.
Number eight on my list, let failure be flashy, but not punishing. Failure in the cold open should push the scene into a new direction, force improvisation, create story hooks. So it should never kill the campaign at minute one. Use the failure to make things cooler, not worse.
For this type of game, I think that unless you're playing Cold War and really, really gritty, I think this is true for all of the scenes. But yes, including the teaser, don't have failure suck.
Right. Yeah. Yes, I would agree.
Yeah.
I mentioned ending on a cliffhanger or punchline. The last one I have, 10, which is tie it to the main mission in a light way. It's not a plot dump. It's just a breadcrumb.
Oh, yeah.
These are some of the things that you could tie into the main mission right after this, or even a mission down the road, would be like an insignia on a crate. Simple detail like that. A face-matching CCTV still photograph of that in a later briefing, a code phrase repeated by a villain, a dead drop location reappearing. This is the Spectre ring moment.
Yeah, it's a business card that you find. It's an invoice that you find. It's recognizing a certain signature weapon that someone has, even to the point where you don't understand it in the teaser. Like, you drop the clue, and the player's like, I don't know what this means, right? Well, in the briefing, well, 007, we've done the analysis, and what we've discovered is, you know, and you go on, and it just wires it all together. I dig it.
Yes. That's all I have on my list of things.
We're through my list as well. I don't have a whole lot more. What I think the takeaway should be is they don't all have to be the same. There's a whole bunch of different avenues to explore with this opening scene.
I think I'm going to try to put a worksheet together for this.
Ooh. Yeah, you should.
I think I'm going to try to put a worksheet together where people can go to the website, download it, to just come up with some things, like some fill in the blanks. You can keep it in your campaign, and then you just can reference that somewhere down the mission if you've got it tied to a particular mission. But it doesn't have to be too elaborate. It's just something to help you organize your thoughts.
Well, so far, I haven't seen anything like that. I think our discussion today is way more far-ranging and far-reaching and more in-depth than what I've seen in the Bond game, in Agent Provocateur. I need to look at Operators again, but I think Operators is similar. I think it gives you like a page or a few paragraphs on why you might want to use these openers. And they touch on some of the things that we talked about, but not all of them. So if you want to you want to do that, I'll help you. That'd be cool.
Yeah, that would be cool. And then once we put it out there, we'll let everybody know that you can go and grab it. And you could use it for any covert action role-playing game.
Yes. Yes. I do think today we leaned pretty hard into the, I mean, for a reason. Most of these cold openers that we're talking about are in Mission Impossible and Bond in my head. Those are the ones I'm thinking of. I wasn't thinking about Star Trek at the time and some other ones like that. But so in other words, we're leaning towards the high action side of the genre. So maybe we want to give a little bit more thought when we do the sheet about what does the cold open look like in East Berlin in 1963? What does it look like in Munich in 1970 when, you know, the Russians are trying to do something? Because it does not have to be this high energy frenetic stuff. It can also be really gritty. And again, you're establishing the tone that way. And this is where maybe if you're playing those schlub, maybe you're playing a courier who gets shot with a silenced pistol in the head. And what you had handcuffed to your wrist, they take your hand off to get the documents, right? That kind of thing. Again, setting a different tone for the game ahead.
Quite a bit of foreshadowing. And I think it's some of those lower action games for sure.
Yeah.
Well, excellent. I think that wraps up that mission brief for this episode of Go Bag. If you are using cold openings, if you've experienced that as a player, or you had something in mind that you've run an espionage covert action RPG and you've used one and have incorporated some of these elements, please write into us. We were interested to hear how it kicked off and, you know, how it might have trickled into something else, or maybe it went sideways. We'd be interested in hearing that too.
Yeah. The not horror story, maybe it is horror story. Like tell us those where it didn't work out so well and why not. And like, if you mistrust this methodology, why do you mistrust it?
So thanks for tuning in. Much appreciated. On behalf of my counterpart Harrigan, this has been an episode of Go Bag. I'm Sean. We'll catch you on the next one. See ya. Want more of Sean and Harrigan? You can find Sean at youtube.com/RPGSean, where he streams every Saturday at 8 a.m. Central Time. You can find more of Harrigan's RPG musings at harrigan'shearth.substack.com. Links in the show notes. This episode of Go Bag brought to you with help from the following field operatives, special agents, black ops directors, and friendlies: Joe Swick, Roger French, Mirko Froelich, Tony Sugarloaf Baker, Huscaro, Laramie Wall, Eileen Barnes, Heptalima, Aaron Relia, Wayne Peacock, Old School DM, Jeff Walken, Yorkis Rex, Eric Salzwedel, Phil McClory, Jason Hobbs, Michael O'Holland, Remy Bilodeau, Crystal Eggstad, Eric Avia, Vornak, Brian Kurtz, Chad Glayman, Jim Ingram, Orcus Dorcas, Chris Shore, Brian Rumble, Victor Wyatt, Kevin Keneally, Andy Hall, Jason Weitzel, Salt Hart, Kelly K. Ness, Tad Leckman, Nicholas Abruzzo, Matthew Catron, Curtis Takahashi, Angela Murray, Mr. White 20, Jason Connerly, Shannon Olson, Ryan West, Kristen McLean, Larry Hollis, Glenn Seal, Jake at Faded Quill Gaming, Tess Trekkie, Tim Jensen, Kelly Ness, Nubis, Christopher Lang, Crowlog, Peter Skanes, and 1D4 Con James. Thank you, agents. We appreciate it.